And if you recall and you've watched that movie, she's just mad at everybody for no particular reason and just mad all day long.
Right. Yeah.
She's literally me.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Generational Thing podcast. I'm your host, Angela Latham.
And I am also your host, Natalia Latham. And folks, we have got a very special episode today, okay? Not only are we continuing our Women's History Month focus on feminism, but also, in just a few moments, we will be having a very, very special guest join us to help us out with that.
Yes, it's very exciting. First of all, we just want to take a second before all of that to give a big thank you to all of our listeners, both yes. first-timers and regulars alike. Yay!
Yep. Yay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Remember, though, that besides listening, there are a few other really important ways to support our show. Following us on Apple or whatever platform you listen to is a big deal. So is giving us a review.
Yes, it certainly is. And, hey, if you like what you hear, love our vibe, love us even, dare I say, please just take that spare minute to rate us, if you will. And even better yet, put your feelings in writing in a review on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, or wherever you get your pods. We love your input however it comes to us, whenever, however, wherever.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. We love getting your thoughts, your suggestions for topics you'd like us to cover, anything, even your pet stories.
Even your pet peeve stories.
Especially those, actually. Yeah, y'all get the idea.
At a minimum, recommend us to your friends or on social media. Do help us grow this show so that we can score even more great guests like the one we have today and get a wider array of your input.
This is how things work in this digital age. So remember that we are at A Generational Thing Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And you can also email us at agenerationalthingpodcast@gmail.com.
Welcome, Dr. Kim Nguyen, to A Generational Thing Podcast. Welcome.
Yay,
so happy to have
welcome.
You.
Yes, and before we get started here today, I just want to mention a few quick things that our listeners should know before we begin. You, my friend, are quite the accomplished woman. Dr. Kim Hong Nguyen, she, they, is a scholar of Vietnamese descent appointed as Associate Professor of Communication Arts and Gender and Social Justice at the University of Waterloo. Dr. Nguyen's research has appeared in leading cultural studies journals, and their recently published book, Mean Girl Feminism, How White Feminists Gaslight, Gatekeep, and Girl Boss, is the subject of our conversation today. Please note that this book is published as part of the University of Illinois Press Feminist Media Studies book series, and you, dear listener, can get your copy for 30% off using code F23UIP.
That one more time is F23UIP. So I really encourage you to buy the book. It's so much of a joy to read it. I want to congratulate you. So much to process. My one regret is that we have only a brief time, relatively speaking, here today to process what you've written. Before we jump into it all, though, for our listeners' sake, maybe Natalia and I should do a little bit of framing first.
Yes, just a tiny bit, perhaps. As our regular listeners know, we recently honored Black History Month by interrogating whiteness, especially as it relates to racism. And for our most recent episode, we honored Women's History Month by looking at feminism, mostly through a generational lens.
So when we planned our Women's History Month episodes, we had in mind to continue our exploration, our critique of whiteness, but as it pertains to feminism.
Yes, and feminism does come up a lot on our show anyway, so we thought it would be a good idea to be a bit more reflective about it, investigate it a little bit, rather than just throw that dirty F word around so casually, you know?
So one day back in January, I was looking through my Google Scholar alerts on feminist history when up popped your new book. I'm going to give that title one more time, Mean Girl Feminism, How White Feminists Gaslight, Gatekeep, and Girl Boss. It was just then coming out, and after a little exploration, I immediately downloaded a copy and started reading it. Wow.
Yeah. I second that. And the second thing that she did was send a link of it to me. And I too said, wow. And also, what an iconic title.
So here we are. And in the interest of time, we'd like to start pummeling you with questions and comments, if that's okay.
Yes, let's go. And that was an amazing introduction. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you for being here.
Well, I certainly, again, I appreciate the extensive in-depth research that you've done. And you've included so many examples from pop culture to build your argument in this book, which I think is a real benefit. Let me just start sort of broadly, though. Can you say a little bit about what drew you to do this work, this research?
I think to play off of Taylor Swift right now, I think feminism is in a Mean Girl era. The literature on feminism, the feminist colleagues and co-workers and professors I've encountered can be quite mean. And I would probably include myself in that mix as well, as a recovering mean girl feminist, if you will. I wanted to engage this because I think conflict is part of any social justice organizing and literature. But I think something is unique in terms of feminism, and in particular, how it shows up with white women who self-identify as feminists.
Wow. That gives me hope to hear that you are also in recovery of mean girl feminism, because I feel that I'm in the same place after reading your book.
Questioning everything we do now.
No, literally. So even though you've written a whole book to help us define it, just for the sake of those who haven't read your book just quite yet, could you please give us a quick working definition of what you mean by mean girl feminism?
Yeah, so mean girl feminism is the idea that being sassy and ironic and sarcastic is a way of performing feminism and combating patriarchal power. That when women challenge the gender stereotype of being nice, meanness, unfortunately, is celebrated as part of the image of feminism and not abiding by patriarchy.
The way that you literally just described me. One of the popular ways to think about feminism, as we've discussed, is the wave metaphor, even though it isn't universally embraced. And we did give a brief outline of the waves in our last episode with that caveat, too. But we have found it to be quite helpful relative to considering these generational changes in feminism over time. And with that in mind, and of course, to the extent that there may be overlap with that wave theory of feminist history, can you talk a little bit about whether you think mean girl feminism has generational features? Like, for example, do you see mean girl feminism as more common in recent generations? Like, was bra burning really just an earlier version of mean girl feminism than, say, identifying as a man eater or a bad bitch in your Instagram bio or anything?
So does this mean that you're a man eater, Natalia? Do you self-identify that on your Instagram bio?
You know this song that's like, she's a man eater.
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Love it. Maybe I do.
First off, let me say that I think I'm of the school of thought that also rejects the wave metaphor. I think white feminism has invented a whole bunch of ways to avoid talking about whiteness. And white feminism has created new feminisms to also basically not talk about how feminism is so white. So first wave, second wave, post-feminism don't name how white women, because of their whiteness and alignment with white men and complicity to white supremacy, are part of the problem. So if white feminism was serious about its own waves, then it would consider the critique of third wave feminism, that feminism needs to engage with race, class, sexuality, and ability as well. In fact, when I read the work of white feminists, this is where I begin. Is this writer contending with race in addition to gender? And more often than not, they aren't. They are overly focused on gender so much so that everything hinges on gender without regard to race or other aspects of identity. And so because everything hinges on gender, it seems as if feminist organizing and advocacy doesn't exist today. And in essence, it's kind of like this self-fulfilling prophecy or circular argument that we are living in a post-feminist moment. So having said that, does meanness look different for, say, Gen Z versus millennial versus boomer? I would say not really. Mm-hmm. I would say that the mean character types that I discuss, like girl boss, power couple, wife, white lady of liberal reason, etc., are all examples of meanness across generations. There are probably more power couple wife examples in the boomer generation category, simply due to an age of having been married, but maybe more girl bosses across all generations simply because both young and old people work. Mm-hmm. And maybe more Karen simply because, well, you know, Karen.
Because Karens.
I really just have to respond briefly to that. I you know, we treaded carefully with waves and presented them as here's sort of the basic layout of that, if you follow that theory. But I'm really glad to hear you articulate so well the counter argument to that, which I don't feel we did as robustly as we should have in our last episode, which was a little more general anyway. But yeah, so I really appreciate hearing that. And I think we're going to end up landing on some of those terms you mentioned again here and there throughout our conversation. So let me just move on right now. The next question, overarching question, has to do with racism, and yet it's going to take us a minute to get there. So we're going to offer some context first, in part for the listeners who haven't read the book, of course. So when we were exploring whiteness in our previous episodes, we talked about quite extensively how racism is so endemic in the U.S. that it doesn't even register consciously for most white people. So trying to draw some connections between the broader discussions we had and then moving to this one that focuses on white feminism, I'd like to process the racist aspects of mean girl feminism, which, as you've indicated by your definition, is white, a form of white feminism. You use some really vivid phrases that I want to be sure our listeners hear. Blackface girl boss, fighting sexism with racism, and my personal favorite, confused intersectionality, as you know, all of which you describe as aspects of mean girl feminism.
Yeah, and to piggyback off of those phrases, your quote by Ruby Hamad also felt particularly important to me. The one specifically where she talks about how hard it is for us to recognize that white supremacy is a kind of group delusion from which feminism is not exempt either. And I think that the thought and the hope is, well, I'm a feminist. I'm a good person. But clearly it is not that simple. And I feel like maybe people who identify as feminists might not see the connection that you and Hamad make between feminism and white supremacy.
Yeah. Okay, so I know we've really piled it on there, both of us, like adding in our hair. Oh, I love this. I love this. Yeah. So you don't, of course, have to respond to everything we've said or quoted. But we include those, again, to contextualize. Our overall question basically comes down to a pretty simple, straightforward thing, and that is, could you please elaborate on the area of your theorizing that addresses racism within white feminism?
Yeah, so I think that there is where I want to begin is on this unhealthy obsession with the word and identity of feminist. Who identifies as a feminist and why don't more? Is this particular behavior feminist? And as an academic, I'll say that a lot of students early on when they come into a gender studies class this is what they want to talk about. They want to talk about that self-identity piece and make that an important hinge. But unfortunately, their criticism, their critical thought often stops there. And for me, I would want to ask, why don't white people care about whether they self-identify as anti-racist, for example?
Oh, good question.
It's time, I think, for white women to ask themselves, how do they express solidarity and care to Black and brown people in the room at the same time as there might be white men? And I think it's relatively fair to say that we raise people to be mindful of their behavior and how they act. We know that we raise kids as gendered, and white feminists have encouraged us to problematize that, and for good reason, in the sense that we should not have unfair expectations about manners or capabilities or dress, for example, for boys or girls. This is important work, no doubt. But I also think white people have not thought about those same kinds of micro-level expectations about racialized people versus white people. And what can white people do that racialized people cannot, or receive punitive effects because of it? So for me, this means that when white feminists want to abandon gender stereotypes, white feminists will often do the reverse of the stereotypes rather than meaningfully combat the system that created the stereotypes in the first place, which is also a system that helped create enslavement and many other forms of racism and oppression. So instead of white women in yesteryear being nice while racist, they're just now being mean while racist and thinking that they're being radical, inventive, different, on trend, and ultimately feminist. And this opens up the kind of character types that we were talking about earlier, like the girl boss, the power couple, life the Karen. It's worth mentioning that the Karen is not angry, but mean, because her tone performance is ultimately about her, not about a collective liberatory goal. Following people who study anger, anger is a reaction from and to oppression. So a synonym I work from is rage, from Carol Anderson, where she argues that white rage emerged during and after slavery, when white people realized that ultimately they had to treat Black people, as humans. Yeah.
That's powerful.
So when white feminists embrace that negative feeling, I'm evaluating that between these three terms, rage, meanness, and anger.
Wow. And just to be clear, do you think that this meanness, like the white rage that you're speaking of after the abolition of slavery, do you think that people who identify as feminists who are white also, do you think that they just don't realize that the roots of that rage come from that?
Yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
Beautiful. Yes. Love it.
That's exactly why this book happened.
Yes.
Yep.
great.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, that is so helpful. I'm thinking about one thing you just said that I think I know the answer to, but I want to make sure. You said that they did the reverse of the stereotype is part of the performance. And I think that gets at what you said about a blackface girl boss. Am I right on that connection?
Yeah.
So I found that section of your writing really fascinating. And just, I hadn't thought about it that way before. Of course, I'm, familiar with the origins of the of the performance of blackface in minstrelsy history all around the enslavement and right. that period and well after. But I had just never thought about when someone goes into girl boss mode,
right.
That petulance, that snobbery, that whatever is there in that performance is an appropriation.
Yeah, you're doing it, Angela.
Well, the lights are coming on.
You know, I think that Angela and I said that to ourselves many times over the course of reading your book. We were like, wow, I never thought about it that way. Whenever you put it in words and terms like this, it's like, oh, man. How do we not all realize this, you know?
Well, yeah. And yeah, there are just, again, this is another request for people to read. I mean, you're being so clear and it's so great to hear you say these things in your own voice. But to read on the page and have something jump out at you like that is just, I find that so rich about the experience of reading your book. That phrase I said earlier that I quoted of you, fighting sexism with racism. Mm-hmm. I thought that was especially clear in all of this that you're talking about, too, that that's often the strategy. And, you know, I have, a bit of understanding of performance myself. That was an area of scholarship for me. So I really think that treating all of this as performative is so powerful. Not just because I happen to study that, but because I do know the richness of tapping that vein in helping people understand, I think, what kinds of things are going on around us at all times. Mm-hmm. So thank you. You break down Mean Girl feminism fully, chapter by chapter. For example, as we've discussed, its blackface qualities. And in chapter 2, you focus on gatekeeping as illegible rage. And we found as we were developing questions for this interview with you, we noticed that we both had collected quite a few quotes from that particular chapter on rage. And places where your theory seemed especially resonant and perplexing at times. I was very intrigued by your comments. And also at the top of our interview with you, you've mentioned post-feminism. You acknowledge in your book and in some things you've said here already, the pejorative connotations of that word. Certainly, that's a very familiar way of thinking about post-feminism to me, at least here in the U.S. With the overturning of Roe versus Wade. It seems to me impossible to imagine that we are in a post-feminist era any more than we are in a post-racial era for equally obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think your book very much complicates the notion of post-feminism itself for me. So if you could go back to that point and talk a bit about illegible rage and how post-feminism is implicated in it, I'd appreciate it.
I would too, please.
It might be useful to do a comparison. So I want to consider, for example, the range of Black feminisms. You have womanism, ratchet feminism, hip-hop feminism, crunk feminism, hashtag Me Too feminism. All of these Black feminisms offer a way into thinking and understanding how gender and other forms of oppression impact our daily life.
Okay.
And expand how feminism can be more inclusive and better address conditions of inequality and oppression. In contrast, many of the white feminisms that are emerging, post-feminism, neoliberal feminism, so on, they aim to argue and are created to show that this feminism or that feminism is not it. So instead of building coalitions, white feminism is hyper-focused on performativity and policing the boundaries of what constitutes inappropriate feminist politics. So white feminism is now shrinking the activity of feminism to be situated along whiteness and white judgment. A lot of feminist scholarship is developing along these various terms of feminism, and ultimately it amounts to how we aren't talking about feminism, and for white women scholars to ultimately gatekeep what feminism is. So post-feminism is not feminism. Neoliberal feminism is not feminism enough, and so on. Oh. When I'd argue that that's probably very much feminism, it might be a basic feminism, an elementary feminism. It might be a bad take of feminism. It might be feminism that needs to continue some development. But I would still say it's a kind of feminism.
Okay.
And that single axis analysis of feminism ultimately aims to drive its attachment to gender a little harder, as if all of the world's inequities are all about gender.
Right.
And this is that gatekeeping piece that is so strong that I'm trying to sort of illustrate here.
Right.
Illegible rage, on the other hand, is the white feminist idea that the rage of women is being routed into activities that negate feminism and keep it at bay and make feminism an uncritical common sense. So this is the feminine masquerade, practices of beauty, etc.
Okay.
In my view, this is an example of white feminism trying to excise what it doesn't like about post-feminism. It doesn't like women to be or embrace beauty because that distracts from the idea that women be sassy, articulate, etc.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not interested in defending beauty, but I think that this, the way that that argument kind of unfolded, shows how feminism tries to create itself and the boundaries around itself. Instead, I think feminism should have a conversation about illegible rage, but not as a concept about the feminine masquerade, but instead as a concept about whiteness or as white rage.
Ah.
So that's the character of the Sandra Bullock in Crash that I think would have been a more interesting example of how white rage is illegible and misdirected. And if you recall and you've watched that movie, she's just mad at everybody for no particular reason and just mad all day long.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
She's literally me.
I do want to say I appreciated how some of what you, everything you said, but just to pick up on one or two threads, I noticed early also that you had said about being in academia. Of course, that was my career and still, you know, have very much of the mindset of an academic, been out of it a year or so. And I do remember vividly because I did not, due to a certain training in my early life, I did not immediately come to higher education as a feminist. It was the furthest thing from my way of thinking. And I do remember as I started getting closer to the subject matter, how confusing it seemed to me. And that it did take a lot of effort to sort of feel like, oh, am I able to speak intelligently about this yet? Or do I have it right? What's the magic formula here for saying what feminism is?
That's literally where I'm at right now, just in case anyone's wondering.
So that academic gatekeeping piece feels very real to me, even though I suppose at some point I became a gatekeeper too, you know, sadly. But anyway.
I got to say, Kim, you, what a wonderful lead up to this next question of mine, talking about the feminine masquerade and this, all these different ways that feminism appears now and how it's a bit difficult to decipher and like, where are these trends coming from? So related to this idea of illegible rage, I've noticed some things in Gen Z pop culture that I'd like to run by you. Now, hold on for dear life here, okay? So I've noticed a sort of what we've been calling a muted and a monstrous feminine rage online and in trending fashions. The muted appearing in the coquette trend that embraces hyperfemininity with pink bows, lace, pastels. big love for Lana Del Rey, myself included. And it's something that I would consider a type of feminine masquerade, as you describe in your book. Are you familiar with that trend at all?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, definitely worth investigating if you're ever interested. On the other hand, the monstress appears in edits on Instagram. They're usually like different TV and movie clips all compiled together, showing women expressing emotions like rage, grief, and horror in very extreme and almost unsettling, uncanny ways. But all the while, there's this cute little pink bow and a pink caption over it that says girlcore. That I think implies that these intense negative emotional reactions are at the core of what it's like to know the female experience.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think about this specific edit that I saw. Whenever you're talking about the hyperfixation on the wounds of femininity and revenge becoming the reaction to that hyperfixation. So after my spiel here, my question for you is, do you think that maybe these examples help form a kind of spectrum of illegible rage? And if so, do you think one may be more mean or problematic than the other? Let a girl know, please.
I get this question a lot about one core or another
core
from Gen
Z.
Yeah, there's a lot of cores, like cottage core, ballet core, dark academia.
Literally,
yes. And I think for me, the question I'd start with is, how do these subcultures or aesthetics mobilize white feminism even more? How do these subcultures fail to disrupt whiteness? How do these subcultures serve to further people's alignment with whiteness rather than challenge it and create a community around whiteness rather than disrupt it? And so these examples, I think, are illustrative of illegible rage as a concept of race, because it discourages us from thinking about girlcore as part of an anti-racist lifestyle. So what I've been saying in various ways from the book, and then, you know, from the beginning of our conversation here, is what many Black and Brown feminists have been saying better than me, which is that a girl is not just a girl. A woman is not just a woman. Feminism is not just feminism. A girl, a woman is racialized, and so is feminism. And feminism would be so much more enhanced and perhaps even find some modern day traction if it started to think along an intersection.
Absolutely.
And this is why we love intersectional feminism, folks.
And we love to hear about it and learn more about it and feel like it's finally getting into us.
Yes.
Taking place in our head.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. Thank you.
Okay. So here we go. Religion is something that we land on pretty frequently here, given our family heritage of fundamentalist Christianity. Long story, another day. But it seems to me that religion itself is often underplayed or overlooked as an aspect of, yes, intersectionality. And I'm thinking about more than just the ways religious belief systems often shape or prescribe gender behavior and identity. For example, many religions, certainly the Christianity we grew up in, besides being gender prescriptive, are really heavily focused on generalized guilt, shame, punishment, and retribution. That's for anyone who defies the tenets of that faith or religion. So, you know, as I read your book, I kept that thread is almost always, you know, it's one of the lenses I look through. And I wondered about that as I read your book. It seems to me a little harder to isolate or quantify mean girl feminism when you consider religion as an intersectional variable. I don't know if you would agree, but it you know, it's a variable that is often cross-racial, you know, like gender itself. So what are your thoughts on that? And how does one overcome mean girl feminism when or if it's mired in religious oppression? Just a couple of easy questions there for you.
So I think it's worth beginning, worth saying at the beginning here that most intersectional research focuses on three categories of identity, which is gender, sexuality, race, and class. Because those three categories statistically have the biggest impact on an individual's success and the conditions that determine their life. So you ask a really good question, because many spiritual systems have prescribed beliefs about behavior. White feminism often talks about rebellion as a feminist form of being and living, which is important, but it also can't be all that, right? Given your question, right? Feminism also needs to make room for other people as well. And I really like bell hooks's idea of feminism is for everybody. One of the citations in the book is from Saba Mahmood, who talks about, who's writing about Muslim feminism and Islamic feminism, and how, and she talks about how piety and modesty can be a feminist value, not just an oppressive or a patriarchal one. Having said that, I think, too, that white feminist women can be married to problems. And this is something that I openly talk about in the book, about in terms of being quite literally married to violent men. And this is something that I hope white feminism continues to talk about more. I don't think I've answered your question directly, but I think you raise an important question about the relationship between feminism and religion.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I didn't expect, that's kind of why I joked about the scope of the question, because it obviously is almost an imponderable. It's just one of those things that we have to keep thinking about. But I agree with you. I do agree with you. Yeah, you know, gender, race, and class, you know, you hear about those. And of course, you're right, you know, they are so tied to the empowerment and issues that we tend to explore. But depending on which nook and cranny of faith system you might find yourself looking at more closely, there can be, to me, it seems like there could be an interesting way to look at that specifically. And so I'm really glad to hear your thoughts on it. And yes, I did appreciate the discussion of examples that you just mentioned about Muslim women and the empowerment that can come from the way that modesty and dress can be used, you know, as a form of statement. And I would say that I recognize that even from my upbringing in fundamentalist Christianity, that there, there was a sense of that empowerment or pride or something. So that registers with me. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, as we wrap up our conversation here, unfortunately, I gotta say, the concluding chapter of your book is titled Abolishing Mean Girl Feminism, which, you know, after I've done some reflecting and dissected that for myself, I gotta say, yes, amen to that. Let's do it. Okay. But if mean girl feminism is not the answer, is nice girl feminism it? Or perhaps something in between? I know it's not black and white, but I'm thinking about something that a friend of mine had said whenever I was talking to her about your book and preparing for this episode and everything. And her question was, but what's wrong with girl bossing? And at the time, I was like, you know what? I'm wondering the same thing, but I'll let you know after I read the book, okay? I'm also thinking about a quote from a blog that we had cited a few episodes ago titled How to Survive in Intersectional Feminist Spaces. And this quote from this blog said, if asking nicely not to be oppressed actually worked, we would have zero oppression right now. And so I think that you have kind of gotten to this point to rehash it, I guess. The question is, does the logic of that quote work only in relation to the oppression of racialized people? Like, what are we white, quote unquote, bitches to do?
I really love this question. And I think that this should be one of the most important questions that feminism deals with now, as opposed to who is a feminist and who isn't.
Right.
Yeah.
I would really like to see white feminists to focus on the white part just for a little while, meditate on it.
Sure.
I don't think that the answer is either nice or mean girl feminism. I think the answer is for white women to recognize that they are white.
The awareness aspect of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That white feminism understand and challenge how it can be institutionalized in ways that allow white people to share power with one another. Mm-hmm. And how often it's mean girls who get their white feminism institutionalized. Are there more recent examples of white feminism that are not mean girl feminism? Probably. But I would hazard a guess that they don't call themselves feminism, which isn't to say that they aren't practicing feminism, but rather that the coalition building and the co-creating does not involve putting white feminism at the center to achieve the goals of creating a better world together.
Amen to that, my friend.
Yes, you've really been clear and consistent in that messaging, which I so appreciate. And I wrote a note in some of our correspondence and even in setting this question up that I had a sense of what your answer would be, that, you know, the collective good, the raising of everyone, not just focusing on the individual mm-hmm. or solidifying the gender binary mm-hmm. as a primary focus.
Yes.
You know, all of those things that you talk about in your book and that you've just kept, you know, the thread so solidly strong here throughout our discussion. Appreciated that. And, you know, I do find myself now wanting to look more and see, well, who is doing this kind of work as white yeah. feminists? You know, and it really is a bit of a stretch. You know, mm-hmm. I agree that it may not come under, you know, the auspices, as you suggest, of feminism. They may not be calling themselves that. It may be some other form of important work, but it's certainly not trying to call attention to itself as feminism. Mm-hmm. But we could use more examples of people who are, in fact, saying, I am a feminist, I'm a white feminist, and I am trying to do work that is for the greater good, that's not about solidifying the gender binary. Mm-hmm. It's not yes. about bringing power to me and my family or reinforcing right. things that are set in such historical forms of oppression. Well, we are just, as usual, sorry to be getting short on time, but just there's so much in the air that we breathe that is called whiteness, it seems.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Natalia, but after the last three or four episodes, I'm talk about blinded by the white, right?
Yeah.
We had a couple of episodes.
Literally, yeah.
And most of our identity dimensions seem, trumped by it, by the whiteness. Sometimes that is just the perfect verb. But anyway, as we close out here, I want to stress to our listeners how much more, again, there is to your book than we could touch on today. You were able to throw out some of the other categories that you look at that are so interesting. The power couple, the global mothers. I found that a really rich discussion.
Yeah, yeah. And as we've talked about here also, this relationship between performativity and identity. And, you know, even the Karen meme. And just your overall take on mean girl feminism as racialized anchor is so complex that we could hardly even scratch the surface here. But all of this really just goes to say, read the dang book, okay?
Yes.
Thank you. Yes.
Oh, so Kim, thank you so much. Congratulations on your book. All the best to you. Thank you so much for the time you've shared with us.
Yes, and keep slaying, right. Queen.
Thank you. And thank you so much for taking the time to read the book and really engaging it. Oh. Your questions were so sharp and smart. I love them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Okay.
All right. Well, toodaloo for now.
All right. We'll call it good and see you next time, girl.
Bye.
Bye.
I feel pressure, feel all emotion. I feel pressure.